This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes of the art world. Definitely the case this episode. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's episode 230 with Daniel Oglander. He is an art consultant who also does secondary market sales and is based in New York City. Not surprisingly, you may have heard me allude to sales in the secondary art market in a few previous episodes at various points. So now you're going to get a chance to find out what actually goes on in those back channels, in those emails and texts and phone calls. And I have to tell you, it's nowhere near as sketchy as you might imagine it to be. And there are a couple anecdotes in particular you'll find intriguing, one in which a deal doesn't close the way it's supposed to, and another involving a harrowing delivery of an artwork, a George Condo, if you want to know in advance, to a client. This is the 7th anniversary of this show. Well, this Sunday, November 11th, will be the 7th anniversary since this show launched. So thanks for being here to celebrate this occasion with us. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can find Daniel out and about at galleries, art fairs, and clients' homes. You can also find our episode index, a link to reviewing the show on iTunes, our social media, and you can donate to the show there. Happy anniversary, maybe, donation. On the back end, we have some appropriate art market-themed art news stories, courtesy of the Weiss Links, so stay tuned for those. Let's dive into the conversation now. Thank you for being here, and I will talk to you more on the back end. Remind me, is it your Queens is where you're based, your office?
I am in Queens, yes, in Ridgewood.
Ridgewood, Queens. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's
damn right. Pastoral out here compared to Manhattan.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right. Pastoral compared to Manhattan, but it's also the home of Mrs. Gallery. And I don't know if there are more places opening up there, but does it feel like it's heading towards gentrification or what?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's been blue collar for a long time. A lot of Italian families, a lot of Polish families, but I see a lot of tattooed youngsters moving to the neighborhood. Looks like a lot of NYU students and Hunter kids.
Right.
So it's good. Like Bushwick is being pushed a little bit further out this way. So
yeah,
and especially when the L train shuts down, that's going to be there's going to be an onslaught. So I'm glad I got here early. I've been here for like 2 years.
Right. Okay. And the L train shutdown doesn't directly affect you because are you on the yellow line or something like that?
I'm on the M line. Going to be inundated after the L shuts down.
Right.
The L will still run in Brooklyn, but the tunnel was damaged during the hurricane and they have to gut the whole thing. So, that's going to put a damper on things as far as people traveling to and from Manhattan.
Yeah. So you sort of title yourself an art consultant, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And a lot of the work, whether this falls under the definition of art consultant, a lot of the work it sounds like you do is secondary market sales. Is that correct?
Yes. That's so, like 90%.
Right.
My work.
Yeah. And people who, like you, who do a large percentage of their work is secondary market sales, do they also call themselves art consultants, or are there other titles, just out of curiosity, that people use?
Art consultant, art advisor.
Right.
Those two monikers are pretty much what you're going to hear from people.
Okay. And what does this is going to sound super, super rote and cliche of a question, but I feel like it's appropriate in this context. What does a typical day look like for you, the art consultant who specializes in secondary market sales?
Man, that's why I really like my job, is that it's always different.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, I wake up at a reasonable hour, around like 7-ish.
That's early.
Then,
that's discipline. That falls under the discipline category. Yeah.
Yeah. I work from home, so, you know, I could sleep in forever if I wanted to, but,
right.
You know, I have my own company, so it's important for me to keep tabs on myself. So
yeah,
I like to wake up at a reasonable hour. I then commute about 10 feet to my office.
Right.
And sit down, answer a few emails. Well, actually, no, that's a lie. I'll lay in bed for probably a half an hour answering texts from people in Europe and also in Asia, because they've been awake for a few more hours than me.
Right.
So I'll answer those questions. Then I'll read a little bit of the news, and not necessarily just art news, but all news. And then make some coffee, go into my office, answer more emails. By this time, I'm getting responses from people to the texts that I was making in bed. So I'm fielding those. And then I'm usually getting requests for things or following up on deals that are currently being worked out. And that could be anything from sending high-res images of a work after they've shown interest in something, whether that's the front or the back of the piece, following up on like negotiations as far as pricing. There's, God, any number of buyers that you have to put out on a daily basis in regards to these deals. Shipping things also, or, you know, I always like to write invoices. Those are fun. That means I'm getting paid.
Yeah.
How
often?
How often do you get?
I'm sorry. How often do you get to write an invoice? Would you say is it like a daily thing or a weekly thing? Yeah.
I mean, in the summer, it's dead.
Right.
From July to August,
right,
you don't sell anything.
Right.
So
right
now, from like September to January 1 is the time to make hay. This is when these 4 months is really when the art market is alive and well and thriving, and you kind of gotta do your deals now and stow your acorns away for the winter time.
Right.
Because the winter, after the holidays, it gets really slow.
Right.
Like January, February, pretty slow. But then it picks back up in the spring. It's interesting. It's the art season kind of coincides with the school season. So it gets busy around the same times that kids are in school. Actually, whenever September rolls around, all the galleries start opening back up. I actually like to call it like back to school. Everyone's got their shiny new, you know,
backpacks,
jackets, and dresses and things. And then like the rest of my days, I mean, going back to what you asked before, like I'll spend 2 hours working, you know, typically on emails and database stuff, and like putting in, like if someone sends me a painting, I'll put it in my database just so I don't lose track. And then typically I'll leave and go and have lunch with somebody, have a meeting of some sort to discuss work in person. And generally that's in the city. So then I'll spend that time after my meeting to go and look at some galleries, to like brush up and keep tabs on what's going on.
Right.
And then usually dinner with somebody too. And
yeah. So you're doing business in the city, and when you're between business meetings, you're seeing work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, as long as I have my phone on me, I'm pretty much at work.
I see.
Which is all the time. So it doesn't really end. You know, there are times when I have to do deals with people that are in Hong Kong, and I'm up at 2-3 in the morning having phone calls just because it has to be done at a certain time.
Right.
So it's always on, but it's not always like that, luckily.
So basically the day is a steady stream of texts and phone calls when you're not meeting with somebody. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Pretty much.
And I would imagine that you mentioned Hong Kong, you know, which obviously has a very big market and a big art fair and so on. Was that a pretty crucial step in your evolution as a consultant? You know, that it's like one day you start your career as a consultant and it's not like you're immediately connected with people in Asia. That's something that comes, that's part of your evolution. And so once you're connected to somebody or several people in Hong Kong and Asia, greater Asia, that really ups your profile tremendously, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a relationship business. So the more people you know, the better you can do your job. And then the more information you can get too. You know, if I have someone who's looking for some specific thing, they live in LA, then it's likely that they haven't seen things that are coming out of Korea or out of Japan or out of Hong Kong. So, because a lot of people I deal with are very savvy, like they're constantly looking at the secondary market as well. So it's hard to show them something new. So you got to move around the world to find different people who have access to collections that your people may not have access to on their own through other advisors. Because a lot of times I'm not exclusive to the person asking either. They're asking lots of people. So it's just about throwing, for lack of a better word, throwing shit against the wall and seeing what sticks. Most of the time it doesn't stick. I mean, the success rate for these deals is very small, to be honest. Because you're playing telephone and you're, there's a lot of moving parts, and it's hard to get everyone on the same page. Especially when you're talking like lots of, you know, with the amounts that I deal with.
So your expectations are that, you know, you're only going to hit every once in a while. I mean, are you doing well if you hit one out of every 10 times, or what?
Oh,
what
Yeah. That's real well. And say, 99% of them don't go through.
Oh, okay. So we're talking about one in 100, more or less.
Yeah.
That's
like that.
That's pretty intense.
I mean, I have, like, right now, I probably have 30 things that I'm working on, maybe more, at, like, different levels.
Right.
And I expect, you know, maybe one of them to go through, hopefully.
Okay. Okay.
But you never know. You could, you could hit, like, it could be, like, you could have 10 that go through, and then your year is fantastic.
Yeah. So when we spoke last time, and maybe you'll bring this out again, maybe you won't, but you did tell me about this extended deal situation that ended up having a huge obstacle. But it was the reason you shared it with me was because it was an example of of, you know, a really complex and multi-person deal, and and you didn't want to mention who the artist was. So I'm just going to ask you now, can you just give me some artist names, particularly on the really high end, just generally that you kind of are in your conversations as far as big sales?
I mean, like, it's the same thing that most high-end collectors are looking for. They're looking for Basquiat, they're looking for Warhol, they're looking for Christopher Wool. George Kondo is very popular right now. Cause is something I get asked for all the time. And then every once in a while, you know, I also work with some modern dealers as well. So it'll be Picasso's and Rothko's and Franz Klein and all across the board, really. So it's just, you know, it's kind of like a who's who of like any evening sale auction.
Yeah, for some reason, when you were describing that anecdote last time, I was kind of picturing almost a, almost like a Monet or a Kandinsky or, you know, somebody like that. Do you go back that far?
I mean, I could actually go into that one if you want to talk about it.
Yeah, why don't you give listeners a taste of, you know, of what the complexities of a deal are like.
Okay, so a lot of times it's not just me and a seller, and then I know the buyer. A lot of times there are sometimes six advisors involved in a single deal. And in this particular case, there were actually eight. There were four people on either side. It was four people representing the seller and four people representing the buyer. And the artist, it was a Warhol, and the... The reason that you can do that is because the value of the piece was such that your commissions are still going to be really nice. Because this was, the piece was in excess of $50 million.
Wow.
So, yeah. So you're looking at a good commission on that, even if it's like, you know, this was like 8%. So,
who are you representing? The buyer?
I was representing the buyer in this case. So we went through everything. I mean, we hired lawyers, we got commission agreements between everybody, we got NDNCs, which is non-disclosure, non-circumvent clause, meaning you can see the names of the people who are involved. That way that down the line, if you have to reveal some sort of information, you know, you're protected, mm-hmm. or you just don't because you've signed this contract.
Mm-hmm.
We probably spent around $20,000 in lawyer's fees on this thing.
Wow.
And then we're right towards the end. We've done all this work. We have an agreed upon price. The guy has sent a LOI, which is a letter of intent,
mm-hmm.
which means my client has this amount of money to spend. It's like a lawyer writes this letter saying my buyer has X amount of dollars to spend on this piece, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Like we're all good to go. So it was like a week away that we've agreed on everything. The buyer's gassing up his private jet to go to Switzerland to look at this thing. And we call to just make sure that all of our ducks are in a row. So call the seller's agent and we're like, so, you know, we know there are three of these Warhols. We just want to make sure these are the original stretcher bars for the original piece. And he's like, what do you mean three? So there's only one of these. We're like, no. Like we know, like there's this one exhibition in Paris. Like there's three of these massive pieces. We just want to make sure. He's like, no, like there's one of these. There's not three. We're like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, what are you talking about? And then come to find out that after 4 months of work, it was the wrong piece the entire time. And so that was it. The deal was done. Everyone was pissed at each other.
Yeah.
We spent all this money.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was really heartbreaking because I'd already, you know, picked out a vacation house to buy in the south of France. And that certainly wasn't going to happen after all yeah. this fell apart. So it's a lot of work sometimes for no money whatsoever. Yeah.
Did you figure out who made the oversight?
It was the seller mm-hmm. initially. Well, it's like a combination of things. Like we, with the LOI, this is a mistake that I'll never make again. With the LOI, you should always put a picture of the
right.
piece in question
mm-hmm.
when making the offer. Because then it would have stopped well before any of these, you know, lawyer's fees came in and other months of work and late night phone calls and just waste of time. But then I think he sent the wrong information in the beginning. So from day one, we had kind of screwed this up. And even if you think you're doing your due diligence the entire time, sometimes one person will slip up.
Yeah.
And it ruins everything.
Yeah. What would it take? Yeah. What would it take if not this situation? Has there been a case or would there be a case where somebody fucked up, for lack of a better expression, mm-hmm. so badly uh-huh. that you would never want to work with them again?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I have a whole running blacklist of people that are dead, like dead to me.
Yeah.
You know, like right. I see them in public and I just turn the other way.
Yeah.
And yeah. And also like, you know, I, cause your reputation is all you have in this business.
Yeah.
And if you lie
yeah,
and knowingly lie,
right.
then I'm going to drag your name to the dirt.
Right.
You know, I'm going to tell all my friends that I deal with, like, don't deal with this person because
right.
they're not trustworthy. You know,
yeah.
and the old saying goes, you know, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, or no, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me.
Right,
so
right.
you get one chance.
And with this,
that's it.
And with this seller, which is obviously not as quite as egregious a scenario, does he get sort of like yellow card status or how would you put it?
No. Mm-hmm. This seller can't get yellow card status just because he's a titan of the industry and no matter what he does, he's good
okay.
forever.
I see.
He's one of those.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Untouchable type.
I see. So going back to your statement about how you had to dash your plans for the home in Europe, the summer home, was it? How much was that hyperbole? And where do you put that in the spectrum of fantasy versus reality?
I mean, that's the crazy thing about this job is it's like playing the lottery every day. You never know.
Yeah.
I mean, like you can do deals and then you're good for years. I mean, depending on your level of need and want, you can be very comfortable quickly.
Yeah.
In this job. Still working towards that, obviously. But
Are you still yet to have that sort of career making or, you know, multi-years comfortable deal?
I had one.
Okay.
I had a good one.
Can you talk about it?
I'm still living off of that one.
right.
And then you do like smaller deals every once in a while that keep you afloat. I had a good deal that was actually two good deals that happened back to back last year, right before Miami Basel. People need to park cash, as they say,
mm-hmm.
before tax time.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a situation where a couple had to spend, I think it was $20 million before the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And they set up a viewing room in New York with about 30 works of art and just walked around. It was like, we'll take that and that and that and that. And I had two pieces in there that I was representing, and they got two of those. So that was real, real nice.
Yeah.
But of course I split that with three other advisors. So
mm-hmm.
we all were really happy.
Yeah.
And that was cause for celebration. No house in south of France.
Yeah.
Kind of money. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. So when you have those really nice back-to-back sales that probably take some of the pressure off, I would imagine,
mm-hmm.
how much of that sort of makes you hungrier to go forward, you know, with your next deals, and how much of that makes you relax a little bit so that you don't have to worry about making rent, you know?
It's real relaxing
yeah.
at that point.
Yeah.
That's usually when you decide to take a little vacation, maybe,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
not, you know, put your phone down for a week, which
right.
is still pretty difficult to do.
Yeah.
It's definitely relaxing, but it doesn't. It lasts a decent amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't. Yeah, but I'm always pretty hungry because I mean, if someone sends me an opportunity, and I have someone that I know who wants to buy this thing quickly. Whether I just did a deal that makes me comfortable for a long time or not, I'm going to go after that.
Mm-hmm,
because I'd be doing my client a disservice by not doing that.
Right. So to what extent where you are now, you know, in this game, is it a question of luck, you know, where you get sent things like you just described versus, mm-hmm. you know, you having the opportunity to be proactive and actually create situations yourself?
I think it's mostly about being proactive.
Okay.
Because you can't just expect people to knock on your door and
right.
give you things.
Right.
You got to go and look for it. I know enough people now that know what I generally am after most of the time. So things do come to me
mm-hmm.
fairly frequently.
Mm-hmm.
But it's if you don't stay after it, it doesn't keep happening. So you got to really knows the grindstone all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So it sounds like, as you said, it's very much a community and a business based on trust, you know, which is exactly the same thing that your referral.
Bridget.
Yeah. Brigitte.
Yes.
As I call her.
Yes.
So as you're, so Brigitte said exactly the same thing, you know, in a different context, of course, but
mm-hmm.
a fairly different context, but so it's all about trust. So here's where I'm going with this question. And that is, does that sort of unspoken set of rules, you know, about trust and, you know, and being, having, maybe even having integrity, is that kind mm-hmm. of the primary engine that counteracts the Wild West element of, you know, the art market and the fact that it's unregulated?
Yes, that's the only thing holding it together.
Right.
That's the glue of the whole industry is trust. And I don't think we'll ever be regulated. I don't know if it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it is such an opaque market.
Yeah.
And it's totally based on trust.
Right.
Cause there's nothing else to go on.
Yeah. Right.
But also, people in an unregulated market, I've noticed a lot more people using contracts these days. It used to just be handshake deals and your word was your bond sort of thing. That's kind of changing because it is opaque, but I deal with a lot of younger art advisors and then I deal with older art advisors. And by and large, the younger art advisors are much more transparent and open and honest than the older ones because I think they've learned a different way of doing things.
Right. So the older, so it sounds like the what I'm envisioning there is the older generation is much more attached to or its heritage is based in the handshake and and so on, whereas the new one is like, no, we need to do this by the books, and that includes a contract.
Right. And we just like share more information too. We're not tight-lipped about things.
I don't know,
you keep your clients' names to yourself and you don't talk about things that they just bought unless you feel like it's advantageous, but you gotta share information now. It's good.
Right. Let's talk about the degree that you have to be a tastemaker or, to at least sort of be influential in collectors' decisions. Because I could easily imagine, based on what you've described so far, as somebody comes to you in one of these deals and my intuition tells me that the odds are more that you would say, let's see what we can do with this, as opposed to you saying, you don't want that artist. What about this artist? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. That happens less frequently because I do a lot of secondary stuff and people really know what it is they want already.
Yeah.
I do work with some younger collectors who don't have a sense of their individual style as of yet.
Mm-hmm.
And they do utilize my services for that as well.
Okay.
Where they don't want to get scammed, like if you're new to collecting and it's daunting to walk into a gallery. I mean, if you've never bought art before, it's a very cold atmosphere sometimes.
Oh, sure.
And I've had friends ask me who are not from New York if they had to pay to go to galleries in Chelsea.
right. Yeah.
It's not an inviting place.
That's hilarious.
It's very odd. It's not a museum. You can just walk right in.
You have to pay with the shame of being a visitor who gets snubbed.
Right. It's designed that way. I think it's meant to be intimidating.
Right.
So
that's interesting. I'm sorry. I was just going to say that's really interesting because you're setting up an image here of a really green collector who has money, and yet they don't. They don't know how the system works. They don't even know what they're supposed to do when they go into one of these galleries. So do you actually maybe, as it were, hold their hand, and take them to a few galleries and show them how it works?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Totally, yeah. That's generally the first thing they do it's like a three-part thing as far as advising with younger collectors. Like, I create access to secondary market work.
Mm-hmm.
I help educate them about the individual artists and the market. And then I introduce them to dealers and to galleries. And
right,
then eventually, over a period of time, you know, they will have their own independent voice, and they can tell a good work from a great work of art. And then I've done my job. You know, they can do it on their own, and I can, you know, kind of kick the baby bird out of the nest and they can fly free. But that takes years. Mm-hmm. That takes a lot of looking at art and a lot of reading and a lot of education. So
yeah.
But that's the goal in the end, is to let people have their own voice.
And well, speaking of which, having their own voice, I mean, the thing that you were pretty clear about at the beginning of describing the scenario, from what I heard, maybe I was reading between the lines, but that it's largely tied up with value. So mm-hmm. in other words, this is as much or more about them picking strong investments as it is about picking work that they are really attached to. You know, I mean,
yeah.
How would you
to
put that?
To a certain extent, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are in it to speculate, and I don't really work with those people.
Okay.
Like the people that are in the secondary market that are doing, yeah, they're buying very expensive things like Basquiat's and Warhol's and things. Like those are tried and true. Those artists are in the historical canon forever, you know, and they love the artists too. It's not just about the money, but any person who's spending $10 million on something,
right,
has an interest in knowing what the market brings to bear on that work as far as value. And anyone who tells you otherwise is either stupid or lying to you.
Right, right. Okay.
It's three parts, I think. Mm-hmm. There are three things that collectors really are interested in. First, you have to love art. I mean, like, that's A, number one. It should speak to you. It should end up being like one of your children. You know, you want to take care of this thing. It informs who you are as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there's a lot of social cachet that goes along with owning art, you mm-hmm. know, and social enjoyment. Like, the people who are in the art world are by and large very well-educated and interesting people. So you get to associate with fantastic human beings, oftentimes at far-flung destinations. And then there's the monetary value, of course.
Right, right. Well, you used that figure $10 million, which is much higher than I had imagined. So I guess I was, when you were talking about, you know, these young collector clients of yours, you know, who are mm-hmm. so green that they're not sure if they need to pay when they go in. I was kind of picturing, you know, a situation where they could be buying from a, you know, maybe a Lower East Side gallery as opposed to just a, you know, a Chelsea Blue Chip gallery. You know what I mean?
$10 million is more under the assumption of like a more seasoned collector, but there are people who start out at that level. I don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice to have young collectors that have that kind of cash, but
right.
usually people who are just getting started feel comfortable spending like 20 grand is like what mm-hmm. I see. 10, 20 grand mm-hmm. is usually a starting point for
right.
most people. And I
right.
think that's smart. You don't want to like just dive right in. You need to learn a bit about what you're doing before
yeah.
you spend a boatload of money.
Yeah. Right.
Because I look back at things that, you know, that I liked 10 years ago, 15 years ago. My taste has totally changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
the more art you look at, the sharper your eye gets.
The more sophisticated,
the more
in theory, right?
Avant-garde you can go. You know, it's not just all Banksy out there.
Yeah.
You
no, know, I was I was just saying, as you were saying that, I was saying the more sophisticated your eye gets as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's the word.
In fact, and it's interesting that you use Banksy as an example, not only because obviously he's been absolutely destroying the news lately with that piece, but which we won't even talk about. But
yeah.
He is, I think, a symbol of sort of the street art kind of side mm-hmm. of art. And this could be, you know, this is something that I've talked about with great stress before on the show, which is the way that I like to refer to these sort of, you know, there you can say that there's several different art worlds, but when it comes to aesthetics, for lack of a better word, it seems like there are two major ones. There's there's, you know, contemporary art, and then there's juxtaposed contemporary art. You know what I mean?
Right. Totally.
And I think and I think entry level, not only entry level collectors, but just entry level art aficionados in general, tend to enter into the juxtaposed world. And that's why when you go on Instagram, you see these juxtaposed style artists who have huge followings.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but that's when I was talking about things that I look back on that I liked when I first started looking at art.
Yeah.
It's 100% out of juxtaposed magazine.
Right.
Right. It's kind of, I don't know what it is. I think as basic animals, I think we're still attracted to shiny, colorful objects, you know, and that's what a lot of that is on a base level.
Yeah.
You know, it like feeds some sort of primal brain that we have as far as aesthetics.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, you graduate out of that.
Like, yeah, exactly. And speaking of graduating, you know, again, to use your, you know, your straw man and woman, you know, young collectors that I'm picturing, when you are shepherding them through the the art market and the art world and art, contemporary art, you know, you already earlier described how, you know, it takes years, it takes reading, you know, it takes a lot of looking. But what kind of things do you remember maybe that have stuck with you saying to them, you know, that was maybe became a real turning point in their education and their evolution as art viewers?
Good question. It's different for everyone. You know, because the art is so subjective. Like, it's really, everyone sees something different.
Yeah.
So, sometimes I'm surprised. Like, I'll take someone to a gallery where I'm not expecting them to like something, and then they're turned on by it. But those are those cool moments of, like, huh, little light bulb goes off.
Yeah.
This is interesting. I don't know if I could own this piece of video art.
Right.
I was watching a Ryan Tricarton video with some Upper East Side lady who you wouldn't think would be into it. She's like, this is really interesting. You know, it's like a John Rat. Like, I remember looking at a John Rathman video at Basel Unlimited with someone of that ilk as well. And they were really enjoying it as well. So, you never know. But those are those moments of just seeing things you would have never seen before. And that's kind of my job.
Right. Right. You know, it's interesting so far, now that we've sort of fleshed out quite a bit what you do, it doesn't at all sound like, you know, you're working in this sort of dark back room, you know, malevolent kind of landscape. You know, it sounds a lot, and I think that's maybe you can talk a little bit about the misconceptions that are out there around, you know, secondary market sales and, you know, and whatnot, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we're not just sitting in a darkened room, you know, with like a shaved head and like a white cat on our laps, just like plotting about making money.
Right.
You know, we're there to educate people and to spread the good word of art. You know, it's important what artists do, and it's important for people to understand what they do. Like, both, you know, I feel like I come at it from a different place because both my parents are artists.
Mm.
So I grew up, you know, looking at art every day.
Yeah.
You know, I used to make art. My brother makes art. He's Robert Gober's assistant. You know, my mom's a ceramic sculptor. My dad's an Abex painter, you know, so I know what it's like to be an artist and what a struggle that is too. And it's when you're, and also what I always preach to people, especially younger collectors who are buying art from Lower East Side galleries, is that you're not just buying a piece of art when you do this. You're actually supporting someone's livelihood. Yeah. You know, you're helping this person to eat and pay their rent and their car bill and continue doing it. It is well, you know, what it is that they feel they should be doing in their job. This is their job as an artist, you know, like you're doing a great service by supporting younger artists like this. So
that's, yeah, that's an extremely important point that goes back to when we were talking about, again, you know, these young collectors that you work with who are entering into the market and their price point, as you said, is around 20 grand. It seems like it's right around, it's maybe, you know, 20 grand might be just beyond the threshold of the type of artist that you're describing, like me, who can, whose lives can really change with a sale. I mean, I think it's even more, it's obviously much more pressing or intense when it's, you know, in the $5,000 to $15,000 range. But I mean, I suppose there's still artists who, you know, these collectors could buy for $20,000 where it would make a big difference, you know, if like that's their absolute top selling work, you know. I mean, is that something you've been aware of along the way?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard as an advisor to, I mean, I do suggest things that are under 20 grand, obviously, you know, not everyone, that's not always the starting point.
Right.
But it's hard to do that because sometimes I'll work to sell something that is $5,000 and I'll spend as much time on that deal as for something that's $500,000. You know,
right.
It's hard. You got to do like a cost benefit analysis thing here.
Sure. Right.
You know, like I got to eat too.
Right.
So, you know, and if I'm making 10% on that $5,000, I'm making $500 and I'm spending like, you know, weeks trying to get someone to buy this thing. It just doesn't flesh out as far as.
Right.
Me making money to survive.
Yeah, yeah, no, I totally get that, but it seems that if you're working with, you know, a 1 million and up work, you know, as you were in that grand scenario you described with the Warhol, versus working with, let's say, a $15,000 work. Let's just go up a little bit from 5,000. It seems that the lower the price point, the less people that would be involved, and therefore the less work that you would have to do. But is that not necessarily the case?
Yeah, no, that's true. There's less people, but it's not even about the other advisors that are the issue. It's about the collector themselves, because whenever it's a younger collector, there's so much handholding that goes on. You're just starting from scratch, you know, like you have to take them to the gallery. You have to warm them to the idea of this artist. Sometimes you have to do a studio visit, you know, which I love. I love doing studio visits. That's always great. And then, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. You got to do like teach them about how to negotiate and think about where it's, because you're like, when you're doing things at that level, you're doing like interior design basically as well.
Right.
You know, you got to go to the client's home and like figure out, you know, where all these things are going to go. And then a lot of times you go through this work and they're like, I don't want to do it. I'm not into it, you know?
Yeah.
Cause I don't like, cause I don't do a lot of, what's the word? Not commissions, but, retainer fees.
Right.
I don't do a lot of retainers. So that's what I would do in that situation. If we were buying a lot of stuff for someone's apartment, I'd get a retainer fee, get paid monthly, and then have like a smaller percentage for each piece. And then it doesn't matter how long.
Got it. You're not going to do the retainer, so it really depends on the sale going through. A word that really stuck out to me from your last series of comments was negotiation and teaching negotiation. Talk about that. What are the things that you teach about negotiation? I'm just from my rather outsider perspective, imagine that one of the things that you're going to do as a collector negotiating with a gallery is saying, okay, so what's your, what is your first time buyer special? What is your back end special? I don't know. One of those specials.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, a lot of people don't know that you can go to a gallery and negotiate the price.
Right.
Most collectors have no clue that you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
They'll generally give you on the just by walking the door and buying something 10%. Like, mm-hmm. you can just get 10%.
Right.
But if you, you know, if you want to beat them up a little bit on the price, you know, you can get 15 sometimes 20 if you buy, like, more than one thing.
Right.
You know, so they don't, and they don't know that. So I always help them with that as well,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which will save them a lot of money in the long run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going back to, you know, my sort of point about tastemaking and whatnot, does it feel like, because again, from this outsider perspective, and you did mention some names, I mean, Cause was maybe a little surprising of an example in that list of artists, but does it seem like when you're dealing in that 300,000 to a million kind of maybe market that, or for that matter, you know, 300,000 and up, that you're, when you, right. you see the same artist kind of come up into that pool, you know, the auction pool over and over again, does that ever get, I don't know, a little bit predictable and tiring?
Yep, definitely. 100%. Yeah.
Right.
I'm getting really tired of people asking about George Kondo
right.
paintings.
Yeah.
Because also it's like when you see the same things happening as far as artists coming to the market, at frequency, yeah. then you get more and more people wanting it, less of it on the market, and then everyone's just fighting for scraps.
Yeah.
And it's just not fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just, it's, you get tired of looking at the same artist all the time.
Yeah. And for
but you gotta give the people what they want.
Right, right.
You know?
And you use George Kondo as an example here. With somebody like him, if not him specifically,
mm-hmm.
do you know if there's a situation in which an artist like George Kondo just becomes so hot on the market that they decide that they will produce more so that they can, you know, take advantage of that heat?
I mean, in order to be at that level in the market,
mm-hmm.
I think you already have to have so much work on the market to be traded.
Mm-hmm.
But it is simple economics, though. It's a supply and demand thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And he makes a lot of work, too. That guy cranks out paintings.
Yeah, he can make one in a day easily, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a great video of him that the Louisiana channel, like the Louisiana Museum, has a great YouTube channel,
mm-hmm.
and you can watch a video of him making drawings and like him talking about his work.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't like Kondo that much until I watched that video. It kind of swayed me. But yeah, I mean, he could do a drawing in a good, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes,
right?
And then that thing's worth $400,000.
Wow,
it's
that's
nuts.
Sick,
it's crazy. But it's all about, you know, art is worth what people will pay for it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, right.
So but I don't know if he's going to – the frequency at which he makes work has never dwindled, I think. He's mm-hmm. always been
right.
pretty fast. But I don't think he's going to take advantage of the heat in any way. Like, that guy is fitting pretty. You know, he doesn't need to make any more work or stress himself out. Like, if anything, he's going to slow down.
It certainly sounds like, and I'm remembering this from a profile of him a few years ago, that it will keep him solid in his Atlantic City gambling for a long time to come.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That guy he's interesting. Well, I think it keeps him sane too, because he was schizophrenic for a while, like, and I feel like painting and drawing is one of the things that calms him down.
Okay, interesting. So what other anecdotes from the secondary market world maybe come to mind that you want to share, or just anything from working with collectors as well?
You want to hear like really like crazy deal story?
About, yes.
Like,
yes, please.
Actually having to do with a George Kondo painting.
Oh, nice.
okay. let's just get into it. And oh, just as so you know, as I'm like talking to you on this podcast, I've been texting with other art advisors and working at the same time.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm impressed with your you know, multitasking skills. That's pretty good.
It's a gift and a curse.
Can
I
you
think.
Right. Can you give us a taste of any of the commentary that's been going on while we've been talking of note?
Oh yeah, there's like someone asking me about high res for a Nara piece, and that, you know, there's actually someone who's pissed because it was offered and now they don't want it. So whatever.
So that's an example of you having to put out a fire right there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I'm just like, I'm just going to let them stew a little bit. someone thanking me for sending the right dimensions for a piece that wasn't correct the first time.
Uh-huh.
And then someone asking me about the availability of a certain painting that they've asked me probably 5 times about.
Right.
So that's been my text streams.
Wow.
During this thing. But wow. So George Condo, crazy situation. So this was like 3 years ago, and I had a business partner at the time that I was working with, who, lovely woman, Tracy Canale, shout out to her.
Okay.
We worked together for a few years. She's the one who like really kind of sharpened my ability to do this job, like as far as like contracts and like presenting yourself appropriately, going to art fairs, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we had a business together, and we were working this George Condo piece, and we had sold it. It was done. And the money had already been transferred to the seller of the work. Seller of the work was going through this divorce, and like, it was like a pretty ugly situation. The piece was in their shared condo in Soho.
No pun intended.
Top floor.
And I said, did you hear what I said, like, Daniel? I said, no pun intended. It was in their condo, did you say? Sorry.
Very good. Condo in the condo.
Yeah.
And this thing was huge. I think it was 15 feet by 11 feet.
Wow.
Painting. And it was one of those like collage pieces that has paper on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it couldn't be rolled. It had to come out in one piece.
Right.
So I go to take photos of this thing to send it to the client, and the house is like fucking Grey Gardens. There's dog shit. It's leaking.
Mm.
And this place is probably 20,000 square feet.
Wow.
I mean, like, it's the biggest apartment I've ever seen in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to get this thing out of there. And we had been going back and forth with crane companies to get this thing craned off of the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going pretty well. We were talking a few places, and then all of a sudden the buyer for the piece is like, okay, I'm fed up. This has been months. This guy has my money and my painting. I'm getting ready to sue everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this has got to get done now. So I'm like, screw it. We're not going to get a crane. I'm going to go to Home Depot. I'm going to get some ropes. And we're going to go under cover of darkness and lower this thing off the roof ourselves.
Wow.
Like, okay. So the front of the building had construction on it, so we couldn't do it off the front of the building. Also, like, the cops would probably like freak out if they saw us doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So the day before, it was like a Friday, off the side of the building was this like shoe store down there.
Mm-hmm.
So I go in on a Friday, I meet the manager. I'm like, hey, could you open up your rooftop on Sunday when you're closed so we can lower this painting down? He's like, no, I don't think we can do that. I was like, how about for $200? He's like, okay, done. So like, gave me the key to the place so we could actually open it at like 5:30 in the morning. Then there was an alleyway on the other side. There's like another 2 stories down. That was another business. So I had to go there, bribe that guy to give me a key for this gate that leads to the street.
Uh-huh.
So we go there under cover of darkness at like 5 in the morning with art handlers. we don't break in. Like, the guy lets us into the building. We wrap the thing up in plastic, tie it off with ropes, bring it through this, like, M.C. Escher-esque stairway that's on the inside, and then finally get to the rooftop. Actually, it wasn't even his rooftop. It was his neighbor's rooftop. So we were trespassing at the same time with a huge painting. And then lowered up the side of this building onto the shoe store. I had art handlers down there holding the piece. Then go down there, like, drop the ropes, get down there, go up there, lower it down to the other side into this alleyway. And then I, like, perfectly timed this truck to come and pick the piece up at, like, 7 in the morning. And I kid you not, we're putting the painting on, like, the roll gate comes up, puts the painting on the truck. I wipe my brow, and then it starts pouring rain.
Wow. Perfect timing.
Like, seconds away from completely ruining this collage painting. But yeah, we got away with it, and the piece is now safe and sound in the guy's house.
Wow.
But he has no idea what we went through to get that thing out of there.
He wasn't curious?
No, he didn't give a shit. He didn't care. He was like, just get me my piece.
Right. I imagine that's a pretty good example of one of the downsides of working in your business.
Yeah, that's one of the books for sure.
Yeah, well, good for you. That's ingenuity. That's, you know, when the 11th hour comes to roost.
Yep, nothing to it but to do it.
Right.
I would say.
Right. So I want to, before we wrap things up, I want to go back to your family, because you mentioned your parents being artists, your brother being an artist. So you're the outlier in this equation. You're the, like, crazy market guy.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, you know, if this is something that the rest of your family has all come to accept and respect, or has it not been quite that cut and dry?
Oh, no. My parents are, like, my best friends. I could decide to do anything in my life and they'd be happy.
Right.
I mean, I was an artist before this.
Yeah.
I started as a chef in, I went to culinary school here, and then I was an art handler at Phillips and then made art for a year, like, had a solo show, did the whole thing. Couldn't do that because it was too insular. It made me feel insane. And so I just kind of, like, you know, figured it out. But yeah, they're totally cool. Cause, I mean, I feel like what I do is kind of an art form. It's like performance art in a way. Sales is definitely, like, a form of performance.
Yeah.
So yeah, but they're the best. They're very happy with what I do. They like all these stories too.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, that's artists have a much harder time coming up with those kinds of stories. did the artist you would the artist you, even though you were only doing art for a year or so, look towards the current you with any particular angle, would you say?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
No, not. I mean, I still make work every once in a while. So
oh, yeah?
I don't think I'm not a full time artist
right
anymore. I'm not making money off of it, but yeah, like to relax, I'll still do a little, you know, like carve some wood or like do a drawing or something. So
okay,
it's still there. It's still there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's really important, because whether somebody was an artist and then went into, you know, some other aspect of the art community or world, or whether they're an artist and they make work regularly, but they don't get to show it very much. I think that's always a sentiment that is important to think about, and knowing that you're doing what you're doing and you're still making something every once in a while, I think is important to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. It never goes away.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Always there.
Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating, Daniel. Thank you very much for sharing all that. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. This has been great.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Daniel. I hope you found that both illuminating and entertaining. So before we get to the Weiss links, there are a couple things I want to bring you up to speed on. One is this. This is our 7th anniversary. If you appreciate a new episode of this podcast, that shows up in your feed every 2 weeks. There's nothing like supporting the show with a financial show of support. I would love to build back up some monthly supporters on Patreon, which is the monthly subscription supporting service. You can donate there for as little as $1 a month, though if you go up to $5 or more per month, we'll get you all the bonus episodes, the podcast bumper sticker, and this is your last chance to be in the running for one of the Marcus Sivan artworks. If you donate $35 or more to the show via PayPal or Venmo, you'll be in the running for 3 of the 4 artworks. If you go above 50, you will get first pick of those 4 artworks. There's also a beautiful Jordan Seiler photographic print that can be yours for as little as $75 plus shipping. Or you can simply donate $30 or more and you'll get the bonus episodes, the bumper sticker, and instantly become a super friend of the show. Really does help keep this show keep going. We are at every other week, you know, a couple times a month. I would like to keep it that way with your support. Don't want to have to go down to once a month or something like that. You can find all of those images of the Marcus Sivan works and the Jordan Seiler photograph and all the other goodies that you can get as a supporter of the show on the support page of the website. The second thing that I want to mention to you is regarding the hot new Art World documentary. It's called The Price of Everything. It's been out in theaters for, I guess, a few weeks already, maybe a month, and is being released on HBO this Monday, which is the 12th. If you happen to have already seen this film, or you see it on HBO the first day of its release, and you have any questions or comments on that movie, I would love to hear them. I would love you to share them with me, because I am going to be speaking with 2 of the main filmmakers, 2 of its producers, on Tuesday and Wednesday, just following the HBO release. So if that happens to be you, if you have questions or comments and you've seen the film by this Monday night, please email me your questions or comments, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com, as soon as possible. Thank you in advance for that. Okay, now let's move on to the market-related vice links for this episode 230. First one's a long one. The second 2 are quite short, so definitely stick around. It's going to be worth it, I promise. All right, so the first one comes from the Art newspaper, and the title of the piece is U.S. Court Orders Collector to Repay Sotheby's $1.2 million for Parmigianino fake. The seller of a painting of St. Jerome that had been attributed to Parmigianino or his followers, depending on the expert, has been ordered by a federal court in New York to refund Sotheby's after an expert report conclusively found that the painting was a, quote, modern forgery, unquote, according to the judgment. In his 6 November decision, Judge George Daniels found Lionel Saint-Donat de Poirier liable for breach of contract and ordered him to reimburse Sotheby's $842,500, the amount it refunded the buyer in the 2012 sale, plus $158,090 in interest, as well as the cost of the forensic inspection led by Orion Analytical and the auction house's legal fees. The total comes to more than $1.2 million, around twice the sum De Poirier made from the auction. De Poirier, who did not appear in court, declined to comment on the judgment, and the lawyers who initially represented him withdrew from the case. The Luxembourg-based broker had tried to challenge Orion's findings through a second opinion, but De Poirier's own expert, Maurizio Saracini, reached the same conclusion, saying the work was, quote, without doubt, a 20th century fabrication, unquote. Both examinations found modern synthetic pigments in the paint. St. Jerome is one of several paintings at the center of a major old master's fakes scandal. The painting was previously owned by Giuliano Ruffini, whose collection included a number of other panels that are now part of a wide criminal investigation in France. Saint Jerome was first authenticated by the late Parisian expert Mauro di Giampaolo and Sylvie Beguin, an honorary curator of the Louvre. In 2003, it was included as an original work by the Mannerist master Parmigianino in exhibitions in Parma and the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna, despite doubts then expressed by the British specialist David Exjergian. It was described by Sotheby's for the 2012 sale as by the Circle of Parmigianino, when it was lent to the Metropolitan Museum in New York for display from April 2014 to February 2015, it was again attributed to Parmigianino. I think I finally got the pronunciation. And that's the end from Art Newspaper, that story is. Next one comes from Bloomberg. And this is very fitting since we had an art consultant guest. It goes like this. Manhattan art consultant avoids prison for hiding cash abroad. A former New York art consultant who hid more than $3.7 million of her late father's estate in Swiss bank accounts avoided prison for tax evasion. A U.S. judge in Manhattan Monday sentenced Lacey Doyle to 4 years probation with 8 months of home confinement, rejecting a government request to send her to jail for a few months. Oh, lucky Lacey. And finally, an L.A.-based piece from Art News is just simply titled The Gallery Scene. Galleries are adding, quote, restaurants, kitchens, gift shops, bookstores, and black box spaces and auditoriums, unquote, Laura Van Stratten notes. Hauser & Wirth partner Mark Payot told her, we want to create a multidimensional global enterprise that connects the realms of art, architecture, education, food, and environmental responsibility. But Los Angeles dealer David Kordansky isn't so sure about the food and drink thing. Quote, I don't know what it has to do with art, he said. Oh, Dave. Good point. Good point, Dave. And by the way, Dave, if you're interested in coming on the podcast, you still have an invitation if you are so inclined. All right, that's all the inclination we have for this 7th anniversary episode of the show. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you'll support the show in some way or other. It would be much appreciated. And I will talk to you at this point in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.